Hello, my name is Amy Liebman. I'm from the Migrant Clinicians Network, where I direct their occupational and environmental health initiatives. And I want to welcome you all to our session on Dying to Work, the Risks from Injury and Death on the Migrant's Journey to Work in the United States. I want to thank the Occupational Health and Safety Section and its Occupational Health Disparities Institute for helping to organize this session. And if any of you are interested in this section, please join us tomorrow. I think it's actually in this room. If you're an early bird at 7 in the morning, we welcome you to come to a section meeting. Or if you're not an early bird, there's a 6 p.m. section meeting. And if you're not into section meetings, come to our luncheon and enjoy that tomorrow afternoon. And also, if you're here as part of the occupational health section, and if there's some evaluations in the back of the room. The reason we put this panel together is that we felt that in an APH meeting where we're talking about public health without borders, that it was really important to look at what was happening along the U.S.-Mexico border and highlight the major public health and humanitarian crisis. So I'm going to serve today as both a moderator and presenter. I'm going to present first, and we have a little bit change of venue because we just like to keep things dynamic and changing around here. After I present, Dr. Keith Bletzer from Arizona State University is going to be talking about some of the experiences that migrants face in Arizona, and also he's a medical anthropologist, so I'll be throwing some numbers out, and he'll be putting a voice behind some of those numbers. And then we have Whitney Duncan from San Diego State University, another medical anthropologist. This is just all a coincidence that we have all our medical anthropologists. But she's been doing some really interesting research on indigenous populations, both in Mexico and the United States. And so she'll be talking about their experiences, both and also adding a mental health perspective to that as well. And we also have over here, we have two presenters from Arizona, University of Arizona, or formerly from University of Arizona, Selena Ortiz and Christina Trimmers, who will be talking about the role of academic institutions and community organizations in looking at immigrant deaths on the border. So with that, I'll get started. Let's see here. Okay, I have to disclose that I have no financial relationships, nor does my co-author of this presentation, Tim Dunn. And then we'll get right to the point here. Between 1994 and 2007, over 4,600 deaths have been recorded on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I have to say that I want to stress recorded because I think that this number is actually very low, and in some estimates, we think that this number might actually be twice as high as this. Wayne Cornelius, who Whitney actually has studied with, is a major scholar on this topic, and he did, I think, a nice job in putting this number in perspective. And he said, to put this death toll in perspective, the U.S. border with Mexico has been more than 10 times deadlier to migrants than the Berlin Wall was to East Germans in its 28 years of existence. And I want to point out that this is along a border with a country that's our friend. It is our ally, and it is our number two trading partner, and yet we still have this situation happening on our border. So we have a humanitarian, we have a public health, and a human rights crisis happening just right next door to us. And what I want to do with this panel is I want to look at, why is this happening? You know, What's actually going on? We'll be doing a little bit more description. And because this is you know, also from an occupational health perspective, we want to look at why is this related to occupational health? And what does this mean for the worker? And speaking of the worker, I just need to add that, you know, we are looking at workers coming from Mexico because, you know, Latinos are among the fastest growing segment of the U.S. workforce. In 2006, it was estimated that 19.6 million workers from the U.S. were Latino. And of that Latino workforce, 56% of them were foreign born. So it's a really important population to examine. And so for many of our workers who are crossing the border, this is part of their commute to work. And it's something that we really need to highlight as we look at this population. So let's see. What happened in 1993 or in 1994 when we saw that big shift, that big line happening in terms of the death? And really, for all you public health folks here, we should know that the Border Patrol co-opted our language and use a new strategy called prevention through deterrence. And that was a major shift in their strategies along the border. And prior to that, there had been a strategy of really going after undocumented workers and apprehended them more in the interior. And the photo up here was taken prior to the this new shift, this new strategy. And that was a typical border crossing scenario in which someone was paying someone to take them across the river. They'd pay them for the boat ride, and then they'd climb over the wall and go into the interior and hopefully avoid being picked up by the Border Patrol in the interior. Well, as you can imagine, going after someone who's undocumented in the interior is pretty tough in terms of, I don't know if you can, but I can't identify someone by looking at them, whether they are documented or undocumented. So there were a number of civil rights violations and a lot of ethnic profiling. And so what happened, there was a very famous lawsuit in the Segundo Barrio of El Paso, where the Border Patrol was harassing students at Bowie High School, and they felt their civil rights were being violated, which they were, and they sued. And in an amazing victory, they won. And in the process of that lawsuit, they said to the Border Patrol, leave us alone and go after them. Go to the boundary. And so what you had happen, and I don't think it was necessarily intentional, is that you really had a shift between this focus on civil rights and now a focus on human rights. You had a focus on Mexicans versus Mexican Americans. And so this population that had a voice jointly now was separated. So now we're looking at an even more vulnerable population of folks who are just the undocumented folks. So what was this policy of prevention through deterrence? It was basically blockading the border, and it was emphasized in urban areas. And it started in El Paso, Texas. We mostly hear about what's happening in Arizona. We hear about San Diego. But really, this first Operation Blockade, or Operation Hold the Line, started in 1993 in El Paso. And then in 1994, we had Operation Gatekeeper in San Diego. And in 1995, we had Operation Safeguard in Nogales, Arizona. And in 1997, we had Operation Rio Grande in South Texas. And essentially, what happened was you had an urban focus where you beefed up border enforcement, border patrol agents, militarization efforts in these urban areas, and basically pushed people out to cross in more rural, more rugged terrain. And lo and behold, in order to do this, we saw just an enormous increase in funding. In fact, in 2008, the Border Patrol had a budget of $3.5 billion. And that is not ICE, that is just the Border Patrol. And that's over nine times the 1993 level. So you can only imagine if we, in public health, we had like a budget that increased nine times our 1993 level, what our world might be like. And the staffing level quadrupled. But interestingly, as we saw that, you know, the increase in deaths and the increase in Border Patrol funding and the increase in staffing, we did not necessarily see a steady pattern of apprehensions. And so there's really no correlation between the funding and the number of apprehensions. But what we do see a pattern is that the cost per apprehension has jumped 467% in terms of the funding. So that's just a huge amount of money and a huge amount of staffing and effort, which is causing a huge humanitarian crisis. Now, when the Border Patrol designed this prevention through deterrence policy, it was very intentional. They said, you know what, geography is our friend. Geography, we're going to intentionally divert people into harsh, rugged areas, and that's going to prevent them from coming. And that was, you know, a flawed policy. They thought that it would work, and it didn't. Because as Massey and Cornelius found out, there really was no decrease in the willingness of immigrants to come illegally. what did happen was it was much harder to cross. It was much more dangerous. People were paying a heck of a lot more to coyotes or smugglers, and they were taking much greater risks. I talked a lot about deaths, but there's also trauma. There's rape that's happening. There's all sorts of injuries, and the risks are just huge. So, what was the effect of this this Border Patrol strategy? People were actually staying in the U.S. for longer periods of time. What had once been this very circular migration pattern where people went back to Mexico after working here for a while, people were now staying because it was just too dangerous, too costly, too risky to try and go back and forth. And the photo here shows people crossing in the Arizona desert area, and you can't see it all that well, but there are women and children, so that you do have very mixed populations that are trying to cross, and it's just obviously very dangerous. So what happens to our worker once they make that trip across the border and end up in the United States? Well, it doesn't get a whole lot better in terms of the fact that the fatality rate for foreign-born Hispanic workers is 44% higher than the national rate. And on this chart here, the light blue, this is all for Latino workers between 1992 and 2005. And the chart here in the light blue are the foreign-born, and in the dark blue is the native-born. So about two-thirds of those fatalities are happening among the foreign-born workers. So where are they working? I think most of us probably know this. They're working in construction, agriculture, meatpacking. And what the result is, we have a very hyper-exploited workforce. It's a low-wage workforce. We have a very vulnerable workforce with a lot of safety violations. And it should be no surprise with this super-exploited, super-vulnerable workforce that we're having heightened injury and heightened mortality on the job. And I think it's really important to point out, as we're thinking about worker health and safety, that this hurts Native workers. It is not good for the Native worker to have occupations where our wages are down and where protections are down. And we need to sort of consider that whole picture. And then so if the Border Patrol strategy of keeping folks out isn't working, what are the factors that are addressing immigration? And this is just a very sort of just a general overview. I'm not getting deep here, but I think what is significant is to look at the various push-pull factors. What's happening in the sending communities that's pushing people here to the United States, and what's happening in the U.S. that's pulling people to come. And I think it's really important, particularly when we look at Mexico, where the majority of our foreign-born workers are coming from, you just can't ignore the effects of globalization and NAFTA. And what happened with NAFTA and with globalization is that workers were no longer able to survive. You can look at a number of different statistics, but anywhere between 2 and 6 million farmers were no longer able to survive as a result of NAFTA. So what do they do? They need someplace to go. They need someplace to make a living and to survive. And we had a booming economy that was pulling workers in. We had a need for workers in high-risk occupations. And it was a perfect mix. Now, just to sort of emphasize that it really is the economy that drives that, in 2007, for the first time as our economy started to weaken, we really had no new net migration for the first time in a long time. And that was a direct result, not because we had better apprehension and more funding on the border. It was a direct result of the decline in construction and the weakening of our own economy. And so we still have people coming, but we also had people leaving. So that's important too. So it's no new net migration. All of these factors are really critical when we want to look at solutions to what do we want to do with the immigration question, and you really have to look at these push-pull factors. So what's needed? First, I think it's just important that we all begin to understand the risk that migrants take just to go to work. This is really the ultimate commute. We all talk about our commute to work, but here we're commuting thousands of miles in order to help our families survive. And so when we get to the workplace, the value of our job becomes so much greater than that of a U.S. citizen or an authorized worker. There's so much more to lose to lose that job. So in terms of folks that are organizing, folks that are working with the immigrant population to better report injuries, this is really significant to understand because they have so much to lose, and if they feel it's risky to report, if it's risky to organize, we're going to be a lot less successful in doing that. We have seen recently an emphasis on more interior enforcement with the raids that are happening across the country. That's not affecting the immigration at all. What it's doing is it's further alienating, further driving workers underground and keeping them further disenfranchised. And so as we look at more enforcement, it's really a look at safety issues and wage and hour. Now obviously it's two different entities that would enforce the safety and wage issues, but nonetheless it is all coming from the government and we can look at sort of a different use of our resources. And I know that it's not very in vogue right now because not one presidential candidate is talking about it, but we do have about 12 million undocumented folks here in the country right now. And as we look at the immigration question, we do need to look at a path for legalization for the folks that are here. And then for future workers, we need to make it more accessible, have visas more able for workers to come. And I just want to point out that right now, there is no easy mechanism for workers to come to the U.S. I think if they had their preference, I mean, the amount of money that they're paying coyotes, they would pay a lot of money for a visa to be here legally. And that door right now is not open to them. And then we also need to look at, so what are some incentives to go back home? You know, is there a bonus for going back home? You know, what are some possibilities when we look at future workers? And then for those who want to stay here, we need to make sure that there's some kind of path for staying here and not being exploited or violated. And then lastly, I think that we really have to look at the conditions in the sending community and look at development strategies. And you know, NAFTA did a great job at making more billionaires and more millionaires in Mexico. I've lost count. The professional class, you know, didn't do too poorly, but it just really, you know, the working class and the peasantry really took a very big hit. And so as we do development, it really needs to focus on the population that needs it and the population that's actually migrating. I want to end, I mentioned at the very beginning this sort of division between civil rights and human rights. And basically, we have a documented 4,600 deaths, and I think that's a very low number, but none of the policies or the actions that the Border Patrol are doing is illegal. Remember, prior to 1993, the Bowie High School students sued? There was a civil rights lawsuit that they could bring to change policy. But nothing about what the Border Patrol is doing is illegal under sort of this nation state conditional way that we look at rights. And it's a very, you know, that's just how it has worked. But we do have an international standard. You know, it doesn't have a whole lot of teeth, but there is a standard that we can look to. It's beautiful. It's out there. It's called the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that is a guiding principle for how we should be looking at treating migrants. And I'll just close with just reading these through. You know, we have a right to adequate standard of living, including medical care. We have freedom of movement, including the freedom to leave one's country. It doesn't exactly talk about entering another country, but we do have freedom to leave one country. We have freedom from arbitrary arrest and detention or exile, freedom from torture, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment, and the right to life, liberty, and security. We have the right to work. All are entitled to rights without distinction of any kind, including language and national and social origin. And all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And that's the standard that we have to look to. And if we're going to change, you know, border policies that are killing people on their way to the work, this is the standard that we have to look to. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to my co-presenter from Arizona, where so many of the deaths are actually taking place. And he's going to talk about some of his work and experiences of migrants in Arizona. And then one last thing, if you're interested in all of this, you know, Douglas Massey, Wayne Cornelius, and Tim Dunn are excellent resources for looking at some of these topics in further detail. Okay, I think you have to press the first one and get going.
Thanks, Amy. Even though I'm presenting data, supposedly from Arizona, a lot of the narratives I'm going to be talking about, is this on? Yeah. Even though I'm presenting information from Arizona, a lot of the narratives were actually collected on the East Coast for persons who did pass through primarily Arizona and Texas. And I feel a little bit like a migrant myself. I'm not formally authenticated to be here because I'm not listed on the program. This badge could be Chueco, and actually I've just met the persons I'm going to be traveling with this afternoon. Like men and women before him, Pepe Gardel crossed the border between the United States and Mexico without immigration papers. Risks for those who cross without papers are greater than they once were. Higher fences extended over more territory, surveillance by technology-aided border agents, citizen-sponsored desert patrols, as well as occasional kidnapping and banditry, to name a few present-day obstacles. It is natural obstacles, however, that remain constant over time. These can be deadly. Mr. Gardel walked for 3 days across the Sonoran Desert into the state of Arizona. Unlike those who renew contacts in locales where they return or secure rides with underground sources to distant points across the country, Mr. Gardel came alone for the first time at age 26. What set him apart was 10 days living off of edible plants and a band of armadillos he caught, cleaned, and cooked one by one on his way to Texas to work in agriculture and construction for a year before he returned to Mexico. And the slides you're going to be seeing are actually automatic. They do not necessarily correspond to what I'm speaking, because I'm actually going to be using two separate bodies of data, two separate sets of data. So you may have to focus on one or the other, whichever you have a preference for. When he returned to his hometown, the economy provided him few opportunities, and 3 weeks later, he came to the States a second time. Caught 11 times by immigration authorities over the next 24 months, he returned again and again to work in agriculture and construction. Although never injured, he came close to death more than once, and he recounted instances of coworkers injured on the job. For more than a decade, Mr. Gardel worked and earned money to build a house for his family in Mexico. At times, he worked in his home country supervising construction projects. 9 years after his first border crossing, he settled in an eastern state and brought his family. After two seasons of harvesting tobacco, at the time that he was moving into work outside agriculture, he noticed a need among transmigrant men from Mexico and Central America, so he founded a Spanish-speaking chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous. Immersing himself in the 12 principles of AA, he experienced sobriety for a period that surpassed prior experiences with drinking. Over the years, his activism and organizational skills facilitated formation of additional Spanish-speaking chapters of AA and surrounding counties. Once Mr. Gardel brought his family to the States, return trips to Mexico diminished and drinking ceased. Although difficulties he faced with alcohol in his teens and early 20s in Mexico and in his late 20s and 30s in the United States have not been the experience of family members, they occur among mostly men and sometimes women who cross the border after time in the States. Coping with conditions this side of the border can exacerbate an inclination to use alcohol. Mr. Gardel's experience showcases what personal agency and sheer determination can accomplish. Having spent their lives in the States, his children achieved success in school and in the jobs they have secured. Except for the distinction of founding an AA chapter and 10 days of wilderness survival the first time he crossed the border, Mr. Gardel's story shares with those of men and women from Central America who work or have worked in U.S. agriculture. A, persistent efforts to return to the States despite repeated deportation. B, low-paid employment with little job security. C, minimal or inadequate worksite safety with related worker stress. D, investment of earned money from agriculture and beyond for purchasing property, consumer goods, and house construction in Mexico. And E, travel within the States after arrival. The move Mr. Gardel made from West Coast to East Coast more than 20 years ago follows a growing trend of immigrants from Central America who may first live in the West before another state, or who may go directly to the Midwest or to the South to settle with their families. When a migrant tells a story of crossing the border, it is told quietly with moments of painful recollection. That is if the migrant has crossed in an area of high risk. Frequently mentioned is the walk across the desert that often includes a trek over hilly terrain, lack of food and therefore feelings of thirst and hunger, and fatigue and blisters that result from constant walking. Cuts and abrasions that might figure in narratives of work conditions are less often mentioned in tales of crossing the border. Improbable water sources rather than thirst is emphasized in descriptions of the extremes to which border crossers will go, which becomes necessary after the water they carry runs out. Both men and women drink from water sources they would otherwise never consider, cattle troughs, muddy puddles, and rusty cans, to name a few. For most, time spent walking across the desert may range from 2 to 4 days. Nights generally are spent in the countryside, under overhanging rocks or trees, or a large protective cactus with thorns and spines. Singular events of preparation are often remembered, such as Mr. Gardell, who brought a box of matches, which he used to light the fire to cook the armadillos he caught. One may recount an act of cooperation or personal success that was not expected, such as one migrant who told of assisting a man who had been left bleeding near the river at the border after he was stabbed by bandits, or the lone woman who kept pace with a group of men for several days. These two border tales are significant in identifying spontaneous networks reconstituted over time, since in both instances, he and she can identify current whereabouts of their respective companions. For more than 2 decades, he has maintained contact with the attacked man, now living in Atlanta after becoming a U.S. citizen. And for more than a decade, she has maintained contact with male companions that currently reside and work in scattered southern towns. Less often recounted, unless one probes the storyteller, is the loss of belongings. These stories are triangulated silently by archaeological reconstruction and sifting through materials left by migrants at the border, recounted by program staff at organizations that perform migrant trail cleanup as a Samaritan service. Common items abandoned are plastic water bottles and beverage cans, and backpacks and extra clothes at entrance discord in the desert, where they accumulate in concentrated hot spots. To carry too much when they enter a populated area would identify them as an immigrant. Cleanup organizers talk of 2 categories of objects, the first being utility items like knapsacks and plastic bags, all used to carry clothes and shoes they leave behind. And the second are items of personal motivation, such as photographs, rosary beads, coins and bus tokens, letters and school notebooks, or any number of items with sentimental meaning for those who carry them. These discarded objects have generated an interest in telling the migrant story through art displays in selected border areas, such as Tucson, Arizona. Environmental exposure while crossing the border is most common among causes of death. In a recent study in American Journal of Public Health, heat exposure comprised the confirmed cause for nearly one half of the deaths for bodies recovered from 2002 to 2003 for 650-mile stretch of the border, which is one-third of the total length of 1,980 miles. When added to probable heat exposure, the proportion dying from environmental causes reaches three-fourths. The body decomposes rapidly in the heat of summer, occurring within a period of a few weeks, compared to the few months it takes the body to become a skeleton in winter months. Among those who make it across the desert, vehicle crashes are most frequent among causes of death, but these account for less than 10% of the deaths that could be determined for the investigated period of 2002 to 2003. Most all border deaths that occur take place in the state of Arizona, particularly along a stretch of the border known as the Chiricahua Corridor, located in the southeastern corner of the state. Body areas most affected by crossing the border include the digestive system, thirst and hunger predominate, and the skin, particularly the feet. Although sunburn occurs, few migrants comment on skin pain other than foot blisters after having walked long distances over several days. Emotions are absent in these narratives. which one might express over enjoyment of an important relationship or success when one has learned a new task. Scenic terrain which they cross is neglected, as the trek is not that of a tourist, despite the breathtaking landscape. None of the body areas referenced in these narratives is one in which a medical examiner will rely for an autopsy, where it is the body tissues that are best preserved, namely bones and feet, or internal organs if still intact, that form the basis of analysis. For these forms of information, one clinical, one narrative, it's skeleton and skin that stand most opposed. One sustains the body and provides structure, and the other covers the body to protect what's inside. Each piece of evidence is a separate story, and that's the reason for having the slide separate from what I'm talking about. According to researchers, resiliency is expressed through terms that refer to human emotions and personal boundaries when people face trying circumstances, grapple with difficulties, and show the ability to deflect challenges with a tough skin. Not all situations of enduring hardship build resiliency, which comes from experiencing difficulties and having the opportunity to develop emotional fortitude by regrouping with people who are undergoing or have undergone similar challenges to livelihood and well-being. Narratives from those who cross the border provide a glimpse at difficulties through carefully constructed tales, matter-of-factly told. Emotion is absent other than pauses and emphatic sighs that highlight the challenge of border crossing. Autopsies, in contrast, rely on skeletal remains and decomposed bodies and thus lack the luxury of the spoken word, taped and transcribed for analysis. Missing in the clinical story and in the personal narrative are self-celebration of the clever, the brave, and the tough, typically expressed through narratives and music, which display the persona of the outlaw smuggler that begins with northern Mexican roots and extends to imagery that radiates outward to become transcultural. Those with more experience generally travel with the help of a border aid. By the time one has crossed several times, one has learned to avoid consequences of what amounts to a forced march over inhospitable terrain under extreme environmental conditions. A person constructs resiliency grounded in confidence for having made it from one side of the border to the other, which later will repeat for many who cross the border in both directions. One no longer has the emptiness or placelessness of wondering what is on the other side, or the push through necessity or adventure to leave behind a home community. Tales of border crossing from the more experienced begin to show traces of humor and reflection on what once appeared to be an insurmountable endeavor, one for the most part that was recognized to take lives, whose risk was overridden by parallel tales of good life on the other side, in a place where individuals known and unknown tell others of their experience in the States. This experience is replicated in parallel fashion with working conditions that continue the hardship of difficult circumstances and strong pressure to find and to maintain employment when immigrants seek and find irregular work in agricultural settings. Unfortunately, those who seek to cross the border make a decision with less interest in safety than in the security and certainty they can cross without being apprehended. Gone are times when men like Pepe Gardel could cross the border and survive the environment with a flourish of wilderness cooking. Instead, places where migrants cross the border today are those at high risk, given that these places with greater certainty are the places of greater risk. Stories of those who make it, with scarcely a reference to hardships endured, other than the generalization, "It was difficult, I suffered so much," take a parallel track to a clinical narrative that is based on recovered bodies, where skeletons and teeth predominate in the stories of border crossing they tell. This clinical story is a tale of relationships and relatedness, where the burden of suffering is placed on a survivor or survivors, physically distanced but psychosocially proximate to death at the border. The border crossing narrative, in contrast, pits individual against environment when told by the person whose experience it was. Endured hardships faced by the body in this crossing are precursors to tales of challenge told by those who make it as they seek a continuing self-constructed narrative of survival inside this country, working at low-paying, limited security jobs. Some may have the wherewithal and skills like those of Pepe Gardel, to not only find a niche in society, but make an abiding contribution. Thank you.